Welcome to Obesity, a Disease, the official Obesity Medicine Association podcast exploring the many facets of the disease of obesity. Obesity, a Disease podcast is brought to you by the Obesity Medicine Association, a clinical leader in obesity medicine.
A 55-year-old female with prediabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, and class 1 obesity presents with a complaint of bloating and right upper quadrant pain. She had recently lost weight on a meal replacement plan, and we ordered an abdominal ultrasound, which showed increased echogenicity and diffuse fatty liver. She had no idea that she had this problem, and so we calculated a FIB-4 score, which was 1.54, and did an elastography of the liver, revealing a liver stiffness value of 7.32 kilopascals. The patient was very concerned about her diagnosis, fearful that she was on the path to end-stage liver disease. Steatotic liver disease remains a bit of a mystery for providers and patients alike. We know what it is, but how and when to look for it and how to manage these patients at different stages is still a work in progress. Hi, I'm Dr. Nick Pennings, Chair of Family Medicine at the Campbell University School of Osteopathic Medicine and Director of Clinical Education for the Obesity Medicine Association. And I'd like to introduce today's guest on Obesity, a Disease podcast, Scott Isaacs, MD. Dr. Isaacs presented at the OMA 2025 Obesity Medicine Annual Conference in Washington, D.C. His presentation was entitled Evidence-Based Management of MASLD and MASH in Patients with Obesity. Dr. Isaacs, welcome, and tell us more about yourself.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm really, really happy to be here. I am an endocrinologist. I'm in Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm in private practice, and I'm also adjunct faculty at Emory University School of Medicine. And I've been involved in obesity my whole career and also started getting involved in MASLD at the time, NAFLD, a few years ago when this really started emerging as an important complication of obesity. And so I was co-chair of the ACE NAFLD clinical practice guidelines, and we published those a couple years ago and have been really just focusing my career and my efforts on NAFLD and MASLD the last few years.
So you mentioned NAFLD, non-alcohol fatty liver disease, and this is a new term that was replaced by a new term, metabolic dysfunction associated steatotic hepatitis. And steatotic liver disease. Why the name change, and are they the same thing?
So to the first question, why the name change? Well, there was a lot of criticism with the name NAFLD. Number one, it was like a negative term, non-alcoholic. Number two, it was considered stigmatizing. Just to have the term alcoholic in there was stigmatizing. And then the third was it didn't really represent what the condition was. So there was a big push to change the name, and there was a multi-society consensus that took about a year. It was using the Delphi process. I was honored to be part of that. And at the end of the day, we came up with this name, metabolic dysfunction associated steatotic liver disease. So the first D is silent. And so it's MASLD instead of NAFLD. And then the more severe, the more aggressive form of that is MASH, metabolic associated steatohepatitis. And so are they the same thing? Well, they're very close to the same thing, but the definition of MASLD, you have to have at least one metabolic risk factor, obesity, diabetes, hypertension, dyslipidemia. That wasn't required for NAFLD, although most people had that. It turns out it's about 99% overlap. But about 1% of patients with steatotic liver disease have what we call cryptogenic steatotic liver disease, where there's no obvious cause.
Okay, so metabolic dysfunction is really a key component there. And as you said, it was common in NAFLD in the old condition, but not really recognized in the name. And so that was kind of a driving force behind incorporating the metabolic component there. And the metabolic dysfunction is something we also see with obesity a lot as well. And so what is that connection between obesity and MASLD and MASH?
It's a great question because there is a differentiation. And so, you know, obesity, you know, the accumulation of excess adipose tissue is sort of the beginning part of MASLD as well. So having a steatotic liver that just has a lot of extra fat is sort of the first stage. But the distinction comes from when we have insulin resistance, inflammation and lipotoxicity that starts to occur within the hepatocyte, within the fat cell, and then that causes this injury process to occur, and then it's the sum of the injury and repair process, because the liver does heal itself, but then it leaves scar tissue or fibrosis, and that's what eventually can lead to cirrhosis. And so it's really more than just the simple steatosis, but it's adding in that lipotoxicity and insulin resistance.
I often think about, you know, what happens to excess calories in the body, what happens when we form body fat, that it accumulates in the body. And I see that we seem to have a different capacity to expand our body fat. I mean, some people can accumulate a lot of body fat and not have any metabolic dysfunction. Some with just small amounts of excess body fat accumulate metabolic dysfunction. But as we accumulate this body fat, and we sort of reach our threshold, is that then causing these fatty acids, free fatty acids, to kind of migrate back? They can't go into healthy fat tissue, so they migrate elsewhere, which would be into the liver. Is that kind of what are the pathways there?
Yeah, you said it beautifully. I don't know if I could say it any better, but the adipocyte has a limited storage capacity for fat. And so once the adipocyte reaches its storage capacity, then the fat leaves and goes in the form of free fatty acids to other organs, ectopic fat. So it's not just the liver, it's the pancreas, it's the kidneys, it's the vasculature, it's the epicardial fat. And so all of these lead to that ectopic fat. And there are different people experience this at different levels. So some people's fat cells can store a lot of fat and they don't get complications and their fat cells just get bigger and bigger. Others have less of a capacity to store fat. And the extreme of that is lipodystrophy, where patients have, their fat cells have little or no capacity to store any fat. But the truth is that there's really a whole spectrum of lipodystrophic effects or lipodystrophy with the fat cells. So they may have just a little mild effect or a severe effect.
And that's why there's not a particular BMI at which this occurs, right? It's not like you hit certain BMI and then you're going to develop fatty liver disease. It's going to vary from individual to individual.
That's absolutely right. And it varies as far as the capacity for storing fat and the ectopic fat in the liver, but there's also individual variation in who gets the inflammation and the cell necrosis and the fibrosis and all those things are regulated differently.
And so I think one of the frustrating things for clinicians is that there aren't really good screening guidelines, and we don't really know who we should be screening for, or maybe there are certain people that we should be screening for, but that makes it kind of difficult. So who should we be looking for this disease in, and how should we look for it?
Those are all really good points, and I would say that, you know, screening is important, but what we're really doing is also looking for the risk for clinically significant liver disease or clinically significant hepatic fibrosis. And so we really want to screen our patients that are at highest risk. And those are the patients with metabolic disease. So if they have obesity or cardiometabolic risk factors, hypertension, dyslipidemia, prediabetes, we also want to screen our patients that have hepatic steatosis found incidentally on imaging studies, and then also our patients that have elevated liver enzymes. And for the AST and ALT, the guidelines are recommending that, you know, anything over 30 is considered high. So not necessarily the upper limit of normal in your lab, but to use 30. And so those are kind of the high-risk groups that you'd want to screen.
And it's even lower for children, is it not?
Well, for children, the liver transaminase numbers could be a little lower. And also in women, a lot of people say that in women, really an ALT of 20 is normal, and above that may be starting to be abnormal.
That's good to know. So what about the FIB-4? Is that something that should be routinely done? Is there a value in checking that regularly?
Yes, absolutely. So the FIB-4, Fibrosis Index 4, is a mathematical calculation that uses four numbers, the patient's age, their AST, ALT, and platelet count. And it's in a ratio such that we know that when patients have a higher AST compared to ALT, that's a bigger risk factor for more advanced liver disease, and also low platelets because of hypersplenism. And so when those two factors, when you have a higher AST to ALT ratio or lower platelets, that ends up giving you a higher FIB-4 score. So it helps to risk stratify our patients. And what we want to do is look at a cutoff number of 1.3. That below 1.3 is considered low risk for advanced liver disease, and above 1.3 is really more concerning. Above 2.67 is even more concerning for advanced liver disease.
So the patient that I described had a FIB-4 of 1.54, so that would be sort of an intermediate risk.
Yeah, intermediate or sometimes called indeterminate risk. And it's not a perfect test. And so usually what we recommend in the guidelines, if someone has a non-invasive test in the indeterminate range, then what you want to do is a second non-invasive test to help further risk stratify that patient, which you did do with the transient elastography.
Okay. Certainly, I can appreciate the need to try to find those patients that have a lot of fibrosis, have the more advanced disease, so that we can intervene. But I also worry that we're looking a little bit too far downstream, you know, and trying to maybe identify those patients that are at a higher risk for that. Is there anything we can do to maybe identify those patients before they develop fibrosis? Because to me, it sounds like that's pretty advanced at that point.
That is a very good point, but it's fibrosis in the early stages is not permanent. It is reversible. And so fibrosis is stage 1 through 4, and in stage 4 fibrosis is cirrhosis, and that's where we say it's irreversible. But I've even had patients that have had stage 4 fibrosis that I've seen improvements with. So I think the point is that we want to identify our high-risk patients with MASH, with inflammation, and also with fibrosis, because that's where we still have an opportunity to intervene and to reverse course of the disease before they progress to cirrhosis, where it's irreversible.
And that really is important, because now fatty liver disease is really kind of the leading cause of liver transplants. Is that correct?
It's close. It's getting there. I think alcohol is still higher in men. In women, I think it's just about even right now.
And so we talk about elastography. Are there any other diagnostic tools that we should be aware of?
Well, there are multiple non-invasive tests that can be used to help risk stratify our patients. And so sometimes it's what's available. So elastography is not available for everybody. And so our guidelines also recommend using a blood-based biomarker called ELF, Enhanced Liver Fibrosis. And so this is a blood test that is FDA approved for prognostic value for patients with high-risk MASH. And so this is a commercially available test that you can get at Quest and at LabCorp, and it's a conglomeration of three biomarkers, and it gives you this score. And an ELF test above 9.8 is what's considered higher risk for advanced liver disease.
So who should I order that on? Is there a particular, like, is it should be based on a FIB-4 score, or just maybe an index of suspicion because they have both obesity and diabetes? How do you decide who to order that on?
With most guidelines, with the ACE guidelines, the elastography or the ELF score are considered interchangeable tests. And so this would generally be used as a second-line test to help clarify the indeterminate score. So your patient that had the indeterminate ELF FIB-4 score would be a perfect candidate for an ELF test. In reality, we do them more. I do them more. I do them in patients with lower numbers because we just want to know what their prediction may be. and I also do them in patients that have higher FIB4 scores, just to get an idea of the prognostic value.
And is it usually covered? And what do you diagnose? What do you use as a diagnosis?
It's covered most of the time. It's still considered a new test, and so there are some insurance companies that don't know what it is. But I write letters, and it usually gets covered if you write a letter. It is FDA approved, and so it is a little bit easier to get covered because you have that, and you can cite articles that have been published about the FIB4.
Okay, great. Well, I suspect that we'll be seeing a lot more about identifying and treating this condition. What are some of the treatments that are available, and what's in the pipeline?
So the number one treatment, first and foremost, just like everything else with obesity, is lifestyle. And so, you know, we really want to emphasize a hypocaloric diet, healthy quality foods, want to avoid processed foods and sugars and saturated fat, want to emphasize physical activity, also want to minimize alcohol intake or eliminate alcohol intake. And so the weight loss is key. You have to lose weight to get fat out of the liver. And our goal is to lose at least 10% weight to start to see that reversal of fibrosis. You can see some benefits with lower amounts of weight loss, but for fibrosis, it's more like 10%. In addition to lifestyle, which is always going to be the underlying treatment, there are a number of medications that have shown benefit with MASLD. The GLP-1 medications, primarily tirzepatide and semaglutide, have really good data showing improvement in fibrosis. Also, there's pioglitazone can be effective, maybe not as much with the fibrosis part of that, but has there are some randomized placebo-controlled trials showing benefit of pioglitazone. And then there also may be benefit with the SGLT2 inhibitors, but we don't have the histologic data for those. But the point is that if you have MASLD, your risk of dying is from cardiovascular disease. And so these drugs also help lower your risk of cardiovascular disease.
And there was some mention of potentially statins having a benefit in patients with MASLD?
Yeah, so, well, again, because of that cardiovascular risk, statins are recommended. Statins are not going to be harmful for the liver for the vast majority of people. They may even help lower liver enzymes. And so the important thing is not to withhold the statin just because someone has MASLD or has mildly elevated liver enzymes.
And just kind of circling back to nutrition, what about the role of fructose in the diet and its effect on fatty liver?
That's an excellent question. So fructose is particularly toxic to the liver. Fructose induces more hepatic de novo lipogenesis, and also fructose seems to increase hepatic insulin resistance. So, you know, the high fructose corn syrup products seem to be really, really detrimental to the liver compared to other types of sugar.
Is that part a dose-related effect that, you know, if you have a small amount of fructose, a piece of fruit or something, it's not going to be as big a deal as if you drink 40 ounces of soda?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it. It doesn't seem like fruit has enough fructose to really be harmful. But what I would remind everybody is that table sugar is 50% fructose. So anything with sugar in it is going to have a fair amount of fructose.
So one of the other areas that seems to be gaining a lot of interest is the role of the glucagon receptor and these agents that are glucagon receptor agonists that target that receptor. What do you see in the future with respect to those agents?
So the GLP medications have really shown a lot of benefit for steatotic liver disease, reducing liver fat, reducing inflammation and MASH, and reducing fibrosis. But this is all a secondary benefit through weight loss, or at least that's what we believe right now. There are no GLP receptors on hepatocytes, and very few GLP receptors in the liver in general. And so it seems like most of this effect is through weight loss.
The areas under investigation, as I was mentioning, the glucagon receptor agonists, are those going to be a potential benefit to treating these patients?
I think we're seeing several of these drugs are in phase 3 trials, specifically for indications for MASH. And so I think that that's very exciting that we might have a new indication for these drugs. And then there's new GLP receptor medications, dual agonists, that may also be of benefit. And so this is really one of the major areas in the future that we're looking at for drugs for MASLD. But there are other classes of drugs that are also in development.
So lastly, when discussing obesity with other healthcare providers, what is your favorite bit of advice?
My advice would be that, each patient is really individual and unique when it comes to obesity. And if you're trying to manage obesity, I think the first thing you need to do is sort of meet the patient at their level and sort of understand where they want to go with this. Some patients are really focused on wanting to improve their lifestyle, and medications, even the mention of medications, could be even offensive to them. Other patients, that's all they want is medications. And if you really start to talk too much about diet and exercise, they're like, well, that's not why I came here. So I think just sort of understanding your patient on that level of what they want really gives you the good basis for everything moving forward.
And what was interesting about the patient that I presented to begin with was that patient was very motivated to make lifestyle changes after getting those results, after recognizing that there's something going on in her liver that is damaging her liver. That was a huge motivator for her to really focus on lifestyle and to take medication to help with that as well. So, well, thank you, Scott. You can find Dr. Isaac's conference presentation, Evidence-Based Management of MASLD and MASH in the Patients with Obesity in the OMA Academy. Where else can our listeners learn more about you?
Well, you can find me on X at Scott Isaacs, MD, or I'm also on LinkedIn.
Well, thank you for being with us today. If you like this podcast, please share it with a friend and help the OMA as we strive to advance clinician understanding of the disease of obesity.